You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, March 23rd, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I am Michael Jamal Brooks.
And this is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrial-ravaged Gowanus Canal
in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA.
USA.
On today's program, Ali Gharib, national security journalist for The Nation and other outlets. We're talking about the Iran deal, the terrorist cult organization that's popular in Washington that wants no deal to happen, the MEK. And we'll also probably touch on Israel a little bit.
Ted Cruz calls shotgun in the clown car.
Yes, sir.
He is the first of the Republican hopefuls to throw his hat in the 2016 ring.
Speaking of which,
man, I hope Romney comes back.
That would be great. But Ted Cruz is very...
That's true. He's very...
But a very, very, very troubled man. We'll be talking about him. Also, John McCain says that President Obama is throwing a tantrum when his entire political career has been defined by tantrums. Just want to say really briefly, you'll tease more stories, obviously, but we are the three-time award-winning Majority
Report. That's what I said, three-time award-winning Majority
Report. As you said, and what we would love...
Today's the last day, yes.
Tomorrow, right? It's the 24th, it closes. They could still vote tomorrow, right?
Let me check while you talk.
Okay. We would like very much to be the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We know that so many of you have been voting for us every day at podcastawards.com. It's a 30-second process. They can vote tomorrow too, right?
They can vote tomorrow too, but they do not have the whole day tomorrow.
When does voting end tomorrow?
Tomorrow, the voting ends around, I think, like 9 or 10 o'clock Eastern, meaning we're talking like 5 or 6 Pacific.
In the evening.
In the evening,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, all right. So that's your cutoff, folks.
So today's your last full day.
Best news in politics, the Majority Report. Best news in politics, the Majority Report. And you know what? In People's Choice, give a vote to our friends, Best of the Left. But best news in politics, the Majority Report. Ali's going to be joining us a touch late.
You want, let's get to this then, because I want to talk a bit more about it. After making the announcement last night on Twitter, I assume he did it at midnight last night so Papa Count Cruz could be awake to hear it.
Because
he's got to be away from the light.
I will emerge from my crypt when you talk about yes. Homosexuals.
So Ted Cruz goes. I guess you can say he called shotgun in the Republican clown car, and he's the first of the Republican presidential hopefuls to throw his hat in the ring and say he is running for president in 2016. He made his announcement at Liberty University, which is like an evangelical Christian hard right college. And let's hear a clip of Ted Cruz speaking to the audience at the college. By the way, this crowd that's in front of him, they were forced to be there. Attendance was mandatory for the students.
Instead of a federal government that wages an assault on our religious liberty, that goes after Hobby Lobby, that goes after the Little Sisters of the Poor, that goes after Liberty University. Imagine a federal government that stands for the First Amendment rights of every American. instead of a federal government that works to undermine our values. Imagine a federal government that works to defend the sanctity of human life.
I wonder if there was an applause sign that flashed.
And to uphold the sacrament of marriage.
It was a little suffering succotad.
Yeah, yeah, but you know what? I think he should continue with, if this is going to be his campaign, like this is going to be the theme of his campaign, I like it. He should really continue. Imagine Ted Cruz wins the presidential election. He's not getting past the primary. I like this, though. Imagine. Just imagine. Because really, that's how far it's going to get.
Imagine in your brain.
Just imagine. Just imagine. Just imagine. And I want to talk a little bit about this university, Liberty University, that Ted Cruz chose to make his very important announcement that he will be running for president in. You might remember last time it sort of made news like this. Mitt Romney did the commencement speech there. And the best way to really talk about this evangelical Christian university, I guess, is to talk about its founder, Jerry Falwell. Great guy. Yes, Michael, great guy. He was an opponent of civil rights. In fact, I believe he even called it, this is verbatim what he said then. I believe he called civil rights civil wrongs.
I see what he did there.
A very clever guy. He was a proponent of segregation. He fought for schools to be segregated. He wasn't a very good guy. I believe he called civil rights leaders and Martin Luther King Jr. specifically communists, which maybe that's why Ted Cruz likes the guy. but I think the best way to really sum up Jerry Falwell, and in turn summing up Liberty University, is to play this clip from September 13th, 2001, when Jerry Falwell joined your good friend and mine, Pat Robertson, on the 700 Club.
This is the first time that we've been attacked on our soil. First time, and by far, the worst results. And I fear, as Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, said yesterday, that this is only the beginning. And with biological warfare available to these monsters, the Husseins, the Bin Ladens, Arafats, what we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if in fact God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve.
Well, Jerry, that's my feeling. I think we've just seen the antechamber to terror. We haven't even begun to see what they can do to the major population.
The ACLU's got to take a lot of blame for this.
Oh, yeah.
And I know I'll hear from them for this, but throwing God off successfully with the help of the federal court system, throwing God out of the public square, out of the schools, the abortionists have got to bear some burden for this, because God will not be mocked, and when we destroy 40 million little innocent babies, we make God mad. I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who tried to secularize America, I point the thing in their face and say, you helped this happen.
Well, I totally concur.
I totally concur. This. If you weren't paying attention, or you just to make sure you don't misunderstand anything, this guy Jerry Falwell is basically blaming feminists and the pro-choice movement and progressive groups and LGBT community for 9/11. Literally, quite literally, saying it is their fault 9/11 happened.
Does. And then Pat
and this
said,
guy
oh,
went ahead, and Pat Robertson concurs. And this guy then went ahead and created this Liberty University. God, I can only imagine what the kids are learning there.
All right, folks, I guess we're actually ready here. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back with Ali Gharib. And I should just, I think, I know Ali is at an appointment, so hopefully everything will be all set. But he should be ready to join us shortly. We will be right back on the Majority Report. Oh, go to our Indiegogo page, help keep the Majority Report independent. There's a link to it on the website. We're over halfway there, and we've only been at this for a week. So thank you all so much. Okay, we'll be right back.
Back on the Majority Report. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Jamal Brooks, doing the Jamal today.
Nice.
Joining us now is my friend Ali Gharib. He's a contributor at The Nation magazine. Ali, how you doing?
I'm well, thanks. How are you guys?
Doing great.
Good, good.
Very glad to have you on. So, Ali, let's Iran has been in the headlines a lot, really through a filter of other stories. Iran was, you know, supposedly the prime reason why Prime Minister Netanyahu came to Congress. His speech was about the kind of apocalyptic view of Iran that he's outselling. And then there was the 47 Republicans who signed the letter undermining negotiations. So Iran is very much in the headlines. What has actually been sort of getting less
attention. Not to mention Yemen.
Exactly. Iran, the Houthi rebels in Yemen.
Iran-backed rebels.
Well, now we know that Iran, in addition to controlling Tehran, is is getting some influence in Yemen. So, but one thing that has sort of not had the same kind of level of attention in some respects are just the process of these ongoing negotiations. We have another deadline coming up, I believe, on the 31st. And I just wanted to check in with you about, in terms of this actual deal and the state of it, how are things looking in that regard? And then we'll open things up more.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because like all this kind of apocalyptic talk that Netanyahu brought with him and then the controversy over his speech to Congress – actually, these negotiations have been humming along pretty well,
right?
And like, don't tell Netanyahu and the neocons, but it's included quite a bit of Iranian concessions at this point. I mean, you know, I always thought that the Geneva deal struck in November 2013 was a much better deal for the world powers than it was Iran, and now we've got this deal come up that I think is going to be more balanced, and like certainly there are legitimate criticisms to be made. But things have been humming along, and actually it's looking pretty good. And the only way people like Netanyahu and the American neocons are trying to play spoilers by moving the goalposts all the time. Iran basically, you know, and I should add the caveat that everything that comes out of talks is always filtered through background briefings and anonymous sources. And there was a point at which all, you know, there was nothing coming out except for the leaks that were presumably from Israel because the Americans were briefing the Israelis on them. But at this point, there's been some more diplomatic leaks from the world powers themselves. And so the deal that seems to be shaping up is something that's going to be is going to restrict Iran for a decade to about 6,000 centrifuges, which is a third of what they have installed and a little more than half of what they have running already. So, like, that's a pretty huge concession right there.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then this is going to be a 10-year deal, and then over either the next 5 or 10 years after that, so a total of 15 or 20 years, their program's going to be continued to be restricted. Now, what's become the sticking point as far as reports are concerned in this phase of negotiations, because the technical issues, many of them have been sorted out, is the pace of sanctions relief for Iran. And that includes the sanctions that the Americans have on, what the deal is with Obama waiving them, you know, and this is where Congress can play a spoiler, but also with the UN sanctions that are on against Iran's nuclear program too, and at what pace those should be lifted, when they should be reversed, when the Security Council should vote on that stuff. So that's sort of where we're at now. Now, I'm not sure a deal will get done by March 31st. I mean, you know, this stuff is all, like, one of these deals ever gotten done in time, you know? Like, it's,
sure.
It doesn't happen that much, especially because it's not like there's a – this isn't like the debt ceiling or anything where there's a hard deadline where you go into default, right? It just
right.
needs you extend it a little bit. But I would expect that by March 21st or within the next few weeks, I would expect some kind of framework deal. And then, you know, the actual comprehensive text, there's a June deadline for that to be done. But, you know, I'm guardedly optimistic about how it's going right now.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I guess there's two aspects of this that I'd love you to go into in greater detail. And one is, again, more is the politics and the optics of it. In some ways, it seems like it's such a just sort of basic living contradiction in a certain sense, because on one hand we have this conversation about Iran that comes from the neocons and comes from Netanyahu and comes from that whole crowd that either wants to use Iran as a political shield for themselves or actually really wants war. And, you know, Iran is this revolutionary, fundamentally irrational, fundamentally ideologically driven actor. And then, okay, so they're saying that. And then on the other hand, where, you know, there's pictures in Geneva and pictures in other, you know, meeting places, and Kerry and Zarif are talking, and there's nothing even surprising about seeing that, you know, that picture anymore, and Iran is making concessions, and this process has been going on for a long time. I mean, this is not you know, this is not the performance of a revolution or of a you know, a fully revolutionary, you know, intractable regime. That's one part of the optics I'd like you to touch on. The other thing briefly is when you talk about – this is more technical, but when you talk about Congress playing a spoiler role in sanctions relief, it was my impression that the president actually has a fair amount of discretion in terms of waiving unilaterally through executive action a fair amount of the sanctions on Iran. Now, that again would have to be renewed by the next president. Eventually, you'd have to deal with Congress, but it would seem like Obama has some leeway there. So, I mean, you could, you know, those are sort of the technical and the political. Take them in whichever order you want.
Okay. Well, on the first point, you're absolutely right. Like, it's quite remarkable. You know, only the people who are just ideologues themselves. Listen, and I'm not saying that the Iranian regime isn't a bunch of jerks, okay? Like, I have family got their heads busted in the street like 2009 and 2009, just like everybody
right.
else.
Right.
You know, this is a repressive regime. It is not a democracy. But at the same time, it's not totally authoritarian and dictatorial. Like, it has its own politics, which controls its policy, right? There are things that affect that. And it's only the people who can't see or won't see that think of Iran in this sort of, like, in this pigeonholed way as this, you know, revolutionary, reactionary, irrational state. And ironically, you know, Iran has been sort of adapting to circumstances and doing what all the neocons were telling us it would never do,
right.
Cut a deal in order to fold to pressure. You know, the line was always, we need to either bomb them or we need to enforce regime change because right. These irrational, crazy mullahs will never cut a deal. Well, guess what? We're on the cusp of cutting a deal. So they've already been proven wrong with that. And then what's sort of more remarkable to watch is not only have the Iranians proven themselves to be, you know, a little bit more flexible, but you see how plain it is that the neocons are the ideologues here. I mean, these are the guys who don't change.
Right.
Like I wrote the last week, a couple weeks ago, about this this guy named Joshua Moravchik, who like has been a journeyman through every neoconservative letterhead group that you can name. He's just moved from like AEI to you know, the American Enterprise Institute, the Architects of the Iraq War, to like to JINSA, and now he's at Johns Hopkins SAIS where he's a fellow. And he writes this Washington Post op-ed that just says, yeah, you know, we got to bomb Iran.
Probably.
And he's been writing – yeah, probably. It'll
that
probably
was actually
work.
The headline for that piece.
The headline – right, was like something like bombing Iran is probably our best policy. Maybe, perhaps.
Hey, probably.
Not sure, but we should give it a try.
I'm just spitballing here, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it had the feel of. And what's so remarkable about that is that you read that this guy's been making the same argument since 2006, that we got to bomb Iran because they're not going to deal and they won't bow to pressure because they're crazy, irrational mullahs, and you got to bomb them. And here we are on the cusp of the deal, and he's saying the same thing again. And, you know, his arguments haven't changed. If anything, they've only gotten weaker. He hasn't adapted them. He hasn't adapted his arguments to changing circumstances. On the contrary, this is just a man who keeps just rehashing the same idea. Like, he's got it in his head, and he can't get it out. He's the one who's acting irrationally, right? Like, that's
sure.
What an ideologue is someone who can't see reality except through the lens of their ideology. And that's exactly what Joshua Moravchik and many of the neocons are doing. They're just unable to, you know, get past these own mental blocks that they have.
Right.
Now, on the issue of sanctions relief, this is an interesting question. It is a little bit technical. But yeah, a lot of these sanctions laws have built in what's called a national security waiver for the administration. So the administration can say, in the interest of national security, I'm going to waive these sanctions. And obviously, you know, cutting and maintaining a nuclear deal that would constrain Iran's program can be quite easily justified as a national security waiver.
Right.
And you're absolutely right that eventually Congress will need to undo that in order for the deal to be stably in place so that it can't just be quickly reversed. But the problem is how Congress is trying to do now is by imposing this bill that's by Bob Corker and Menendez, a Democrat and a Republican, but the most hawkish Democrat, Bob Menendez, is on
yes.
Iran.
Yes.
They're trying to impose this bill that would allow Congress an up-and-down vote. And what the bill would do, two things that are dangerous on the sanctions front. I mean, there are other reasons why it's a terrible and dangerous bill. But two things it would do on the sanctions front is, for one, it wouldn't allow the president to waive sanctions for 60 days while Congress considered this bill. Now, the problem is that if we sign a deal with the Iranians, it's going to have to go into effect, right?
Right.
You're basically blocking the president's ability to implement this deal for 2 months.
Right.
And the other thing that they want to do is that if they vote no, that automatically removes all of Obama's waivers from the previous sanctions bills. That is what they're trying to do, is by legislative writ take away his ability to do what you're saying, which is unilaterally waive the sanctions, at least for a period. And the point of that is quite obviously that would kill a deal, right?
Right. Right.
I mean, they would vote no, which they almost certainly will, because it's a Republican Congress, and there's certainly enough like sort of hawkish, unreconstructed pro-Israel Democrats
right.
to vote down a deal. And then they take away Obama's ability to waive these sanctions and implement the deal that he just cut.
Right. Okay. So and so that makes total sense. And let's actually use Bob Menendez, who is really, you know, if I could just descend into polemic for a minute, he really is. It would be shocking to discover that he wasn't actually, in fact, a rather corrupt guy. He's unreconstructed, you know, hawk and fanatic on Iran. He's really.
On Cuba,
on the Palestinians.
I mean,
he represents basically a lot of things that are wrong with Congress, not just today, but actually traditionally. There's some kind of old school problems with Bob Menendez too. He's almost still at the send me a duffel bag of money level, possibly, if you believe some stories about him. But at any rate, I want to use him to get to this other really important thing that you and Eli Clifton have worked on recently. It's a story about the MEK, and you'll explain what that group is and what it stands for. But what's so fascinating about this organization, the MEK, which is an Iranian exile group. They're quite accurately called a terrorist organization and a cult. They have a very complex origin story, which you'll get into. And Bob Menendez is a fervent supporter of them on Capitol Hill, as are many, many, many others, both Republicans and Democrats, both former, people who used to be in office, from Howard Dean to Rudy Giuliani to sitting members of Congress, campaigning on behalf of this group, which is really just utterly bizarre, in addition to being engaged in many human rights abuses. So tell us about really this terrorist organization that wants to sabotage a deal with Iran and has, despite its history, actually really burrowed itself into a position of relative influence in the Washington, D.C. policy apparatus.
All right, so there's just so much to say about the MEK. I mean, I'm considering doing a book on these guys, because it just never ends with them, right?
Get prepared on Twitter if you do.
Yeah, me and my colleague Eli Clifton, who's also I know you know well, is wrote this piece for The Intercept, and that's why we had to take 6,000 words to explain the story about how they got the influence, their relationship to Bob Menendez. I mean, it took a long time to lay this all out, because, you got to spend 1,000 words on these guys' history, because it's just insane, and you need it to sort of, paint the picture of why it's so wild that these guys have the support they do. The really brief version is that they started out as an Islamo-Marxist revolutionary group. Wrap your head around that.
So they're like Obama.
Sorry?
I said they're like Obama.
Just like Obama, exactly.
Right. Okay. I think people can get
that. In the 1960s, they fought against the Shah's regime. They were at the vanguard of the revolution. But then Ayatollah Khomeini turned his back on them. There's always been this tension between clerics and lay radicals. And, that's a discussion, a long discussion for another time.
Right.
But anyway, he turned his backs on them. He threw a bunch of them in jail. They got thrown out of the country. After a few years, they ended up in Iraq. They fought with our old buddy Saddam Hussein. These are the kinds of people that Capitol Hill is now pumping
out. So just to get really clear, they left Iran to fight with Saddam Hussein in a war that
Iran.
He waged on Iran, where he included using chemical weapons against Iranians. I just want people to wrap their heads around that for a second.
Right. This is where, you were saying before that it's amazing the influence they have in Congress. Probably the most amazing thing about that to me is that they don't have influence anywhere else, right?
Right.
These guys are not a broad movement that has followers inside Iran. And the reason is because they fought in a war against Iran. For all the Iranian regime's faults, one of the things, and this is one of the reasons why we shouldn't bomb Iran today, one of the things that really rallied the people to the Islamic Republic in its sort of shakiest days in the early and mid-80s was this war with Saddam, which was widely seen as unjust. And, there were countless Iranian deaths during that war.
Right.
And the MEK was literally with heavy artillery, with tanks, with Saddam fighting against us, So there's that incredible twist. They move into being a terrorist organization against the Iranian regime, and that takes them up through about the late 90s. They're fighting a terrorist campaign against the Iranian government and as a sort of militia for
Saddam. And still based in Iraq. Yeah, okay.
So we invade in 2003. We don't know what to do with these guys. By some accounts, what some people would consider a sort of error, we name these guys as protected people, and we take away, the deal is we'll give you protected people status, we take away all your weapons. And that's what happened. Thousands of their ex-fighters stay in Iraq. They basically, after a few years of languishing there, partly of their own accord. You know, they refuse to leave. They refuse to separate out the group. And by this time, by the way, they've given up on Islamo-Marxism. They're little more than a cult of personality, mm-hmm. right? They follow around their leader, this guy Masoud Rajavi and his wife, Mariam. They follow them around blindly. And they start, and they were listed in the late 90s as a terrorist group by the U.S. And they start, you know, the last recorded terrorist attack by them, I think, was 2001. It's in our piece at The Intercept. You can look mm-hmm. it up. They haven't taken credit for a terrorist attack in a while, but they ramp up this campaign to get taken off the terrorist list. And whatever the merits of that is, the way they did it was sort of hilarious because they paid all these officials, like you said, Howard Dean Giuliani, to give speeches to advocate for them being taken off the list. And that's like a, you know, I mean, that's, you know, this money and politics story, whatever it is.
Right.
So eventually they get taken off the terrorist list in 2012, and lo and behold, as soon as they're off it, the guy that suddenly becomes one of their top defenders in Congress and one of their biggest boosters in Congress, and also like a guy who becomes their largest recipient of campaign cash as Eli, you know, Eli is the number cruncher of the pair of us, and he was the one who did all the numbers on this rather incredibly.
Yes.
Their largest recipient of campaign cash is Bob Menendez, the main Democratic antagonist of Obama's Iran diplomacy. I mean, this is the guy working with Mark Kirk, the sort of ridiculously clownish Iran hawk, to write every single sanctions bill. I mean, Mark Kirk is a guy who wants regime change in Iran. He doesn't think we should be negotiating at all. And Bob Menendez is writing these sanctions bills with him saying, oh, you know, I'm just trying to strengthen our hand in diplomacy. It's like, if you're working with Mark Kirk, you're not trying to strengthen our hand in diplomacy. And, you know, this is sort of part and parcel of the way Bob Menendez does international affairs, at least. It's basically a combination of like, where he can get paid and where he can take hawkish positions. And the intersections of those things, you see them. Latin America. Cuba,
there's a war and a BMW in it for me.
Yeah. Israel and the Palestinians. I mean, these are all sort of, it's sort of like these minority special interest groups that are happy to pour cash into his coffers and where he can take a hawkish stand and where he does. And so it's just this remarkable marriage of convenience. But lo and behold, me and Eli discover that actually Bob Menendez's relationship with the MEK, he'd been very quiet about it for about a dozen years in the middle there after they were listed as a terrorist group. But the relationship actually goes back 20 years.
Wow.
Bob Menendez had spoken at MEK rallies in the late 90s, even after they were listed on the terrorist group, with his former fellow New Jersey Democrat, Bob Torricelli, who eventually came under, you know, an ethics probe and was voted out of office. They used to go to MEK rallies together. So this is a long, deep relationship, Bob Menendez, with this sort of wildly, sometimes violent cult that opposes the Iranian government. I mean, that's embarrassing. Like,
yeah, no, absolutely. No, this MEK component of it is stunning on so many levels. It's stunning because, as you say, there's a money in politics issue. There's an influence peddling issue. And then there's also just, I mean, and you know, and I think obviously with Howard Dean, it's a bit more disappointing. I don't really expect anything from, you know, Victoria Clark or Rudy Giuliani or Bob Menendez. But there's also just a basic lack of knowledge issue. I mean, Howard Dean said something to the effect of, you know, well, the MEK, I mean, you know, something to the effect of, well, if there was a real, you know, democratic process in Iran, you know, the MEK might be in leadership there. I mean, it just kind of portrayed this sort of stunning, like, you don't even have, like, you've read a New Yorker article level of information on this country, and yet you're collecting bags of
New
money
Yorker.
From
the cult. They haven't read 800 briefs in the Washington Post or New York Times, you know? Like, you don't need all that. You shouldn't be so shocked at Howard Dean. You know, it's unfortunate. And actually, you know, once I asked Howard, I went to an MEK event, and I followed Howard Dean out of it because he wouldn't take questions. So I followed him out and just kind of peppered him with questions.
Yeah.
And in the elevator, he turned all red and called me and a reporter from the Journal a-holes for asking him.
Okay.
Which is kind of the dude that he is. But, you know, this guy.
Yeah, sure.
I'm sorry. Like, the Howard Dean of 2004 is just that's not who that guy is anymore, right? I mean, this is a guy who took big money from Big Pharma. Like, this was his issue.
Yeah,
right?
You're right. That's right. And
you know,
I think
like,
the
guy.
Yeah.
The guy's getting rich. what are you going to do?
Guy's getting rich. But you know, Joe Trippi's doing Bahrain PR, and I just got to say, I always was a Kerry guy, and at least as by the lens of today, I'm vindicated.
Hey, Kerry's way better on international relations.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
On the MEK front, I mean, yes. You know, as you said, it's hilarious. Howard Dean, another thing you said is that he's like referred to Mehdi Ahmadinejad as being the president in exile of Iran, whatever the hell that means. I mean, this is a group. It's hard to estimate their exact numbers, but this is a group that, let's just say, you know, back of the envelope calculation has probably less than 50,000 supporters the world over. Like, they're not about to rule Iran. They're not viable leadership for Iran. There are sort of three constituencies that really ardently support the MEK. There's the adherents. So let's call them what they are, members of the cult.
Right.
They're like people who only think about and only work towards that and are slavishly devoted to it. There's the paid activists like the Rudy Giulianis and Howard Deans of the world.
Yep.
And then, much to their shame, if they have any left, there's the Congress. And these are the three places where the MEK gets any support. And it's those latter two that have built up this campaign where we just keep hearing about them. I mean, they're totally obscure anywhere outside of Congress and Iran, basically. But, yeah, they have an incredible amount of support. And, like, I can't encourage people enough to read the story and see who they are and where they come from and what they're up to these days.
Yeah, it's really mind-blowing. And as we move toward – I want to touch on what happened in Israel. We've definitely spent a lot of time on this show really focusing on – I always say just getting real about the actual situation there. I found it actually in some ways kind of, in a certain way, encouraging, I guess, but also kind of surprising some of the conversations I've had over the last couple of days, really with people, I guess, sort of getting more, you know, accepting the reality of the present state of affairs in Israel. And then on the other hand, from my perspective, being a little bit impatient, like, you know, really, there's nothing new here. This is what Netanyahu always was. This is what, you know, Avdor Lieberman always was. This is a incredibly far right government and a real large constituency that obviously is comfortable with an unending human rights crisis. So, you know, that's one piece of it. And you've also drawn smart parallels between, and other people have as well, between the Republican Party supporting Netanyahu's, you know, Arab race baiting, which is no surprise. They are race baiting pros themselves. But I want to ask, you know, from the perspective of Iran, what I think is interesting is that, you know, some people would still say, look, you know, Netanyahu, you may not like him. You may think he's a fanatical hawk. You may do whatever, but you can't question his motives because he really is just concerned about the Iranians. I've never bought it. And what I find interesting is that going to Congress and then running the campaign he's run, doesn't that really just make – I mean, other than, of course, there's still going to be close – there's profoundly close intelligence coordination. The U.S. and Iran and Israel is still going to be talking and coordinating. But the influence he could have – in this debate, he went all in on undermining Obama. It really hasn't worked so far, and he's kind of self-detonated himself relative to that process. You think that's a fair assessment?
It's a major own goal.
Yeah,
it's a major own goal. I mean, you know, it's remarkable that you have some of, you know, we were talking before about how there are a lot of pro-Israel hawks in the Democratic Party in Congress. A lot of these guys have backed away from what has become the Netanyahu Republican positions on these things,
right?
In part because they can't publicly back them because Netanyahu has made such a show of openly siding with the Republicans and utilizing it and like relishing and reveling in this sort of Republican adulation that is specific to Republicans. I mean, they are, you know, the Republicans and Netanyahu have just scored own goal after own goal. You have to wonder if they actually don't want the responsibility of killing an Iran deal and just want to be able to say to their donors, hey, we put up a huge fight, because they just the way they're acting, they've hurt no one but themselves in their efforts to kill this deal. As for Netanyahu, I mean, you know, I actually think that he's like a combination of a very ideological and also quite politically cynical. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that he really thinks Iran is a threat. And that, you know, he wants to go to war with Iran. Christ, he almost did it a couple of years ago. Can you imagine where we'd be if that happened?
Wow.
And I don't think there's any doubt that that's real. But also, for Netanyahu, this is a big way for him to distract from the Palestinian issue, which he's always looking for, right? That's the last thing they want to talk about.
Right.
Distract. And also, it's just a way for him to pump up his own image as well. I mean, I think he really does probably see himself as trying to, like, save the Jewish state. You know, I don't know if he views it as an existential threat totally, but I think he views himself as trying to take out a threat to the Jewish state. But at the same time, this image that he projects of himself as the savior of Israel is very convenient for his politics, right? He can keep saying that the left, as he did during this election, that the left is soft on security. And that's totally true. So distracting from the Palestinians, electoral utility, like, those things for Netanyahu are cynical. Now, as I said, I think he really does view this as a threat. And I think part of the problem with his republicanism is that, you know, and this is something we've heard from neocons since the 1960s, right? 60s and 70s. They've been saying the Republican Party, this is why they switched parties. You know, it used to be that you could be a Scoop Jackson Democrat. You could basically be a neocon Democrat. But they switched to the Republican Party because Norman Podoretz, in large part, wrote all these polemics about how, you know, and Irving Kristol is another one, the sort of godfathers, two of the godfathers of neoconservatism, about how it's just like they don't think that Democrats are suitable to Israel's interest.
Right.
And so I think that really is an ideological belief and alignment on the part of Netanyahu and Likud, where they think that that Democrats just can't do it. And the only hope for these guys is a permanent Republican majority in the White House and in Congress. Unfortunately for them, at least on the executive side in the White House, that isn't how things are shaking out in America. But I think that they really do view it that way. And that might be, you know, unless they're just being cynical and trying to raise the alarm without killing the deal, that explains their sort of unabashed reliance on Republicans and partisan Republican efforts to try and kill this deal.
Do you think, though,
they think that these are the only guys who can do it?
Do you think, though, I mean, as a final question about this before we wrap up, do you think that his strategy is just, you know, the well with Obama is completely poisoned, so, you know, he'll walk it back a little bit because it got so over the top, but I think, you know, he's basically planning on either there'll be a Republican or the assumption – And you know, I think we do have to touch on Hillary just for a moment, that, you know, a President Hillary Clinton is going to be much more back in this, you know, Israel at all times, no matter what mode. And I just wonder, both in terms of, you know, her position and what she takes on Iran is going to be important. And then also, it does seem to be a little bit less viable to have this progressive except Palestine position moving forward, and not that she's going to move significantly to the left on that issue, but can you run a Democratic campaign in the future where you just sort of glide over that issue and kind of mouth cliches about Israeli security and not, you know, address that full stop? And you know, because my assumption is that Netanyahu just thinks either way, preferably Republican, but Hillary too, she's on board. I just got to wait this guy out.
Well, I mean, you'd think he wouldn't think that, like, hopefully he's learned his lesson about backing Republicans in presidential races and what that could do. I mean, that got him into trouble with what was quite rightly seen as basically an endorsement of Romney during the 2012 campaign, and that came back and bit him in the butt. As far as Hillary, that's an interesting point. You know, I actually think that Hillary is cynical on this one.
Yeah.
And the reason that she... You know, I think she does have some hawkish tendencies, but I think she's less hawkish than she lets on.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is partly the gender issue, that she thinks that she'll get hit for being a woman and being soft on security. I mean, we know the Republicans are going to hit whatever Democrat it is with this. But even if that's the case, I mean, it's hard not to view Netanyahu's actions as again, an own goal. Because things that they're, you know... The Democratic grassroots is already turning against Israel, like, and not turning against Israel, you know, like, I wouldn't say that the Democratic grassroots even is at the point where they're saying, let's dismantle the Jewish state or anything like that. But they're at least not buying the Likud spin on everything.
No.
Right. Then they're sort of starting to see what you said before, that there's a remarkable discourse having now where even like Will Salatin at Slate is writing columns saying, this is a right-wing country, right? This is not a Netanyahu problem. This is an Israel problem.
Right.
When people are starting to see that and understand that and adjust policies accordingly, and this has been happening in the Democratic grassroots for a while. You know, you'll remember the Jerusalem platform fight
yes.
from the 2012 campaign. And now Netanyahu has forced the issue and caused this Democratic disquiet to filter up to national politics, right? Now it's happening in Congress too, where you have even like hawkish pro-Israel Democrats backing away from the stuff. You know, you see the way like Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein talk about Israel. It's a totally new game out there.
Right. Right.
And so Hillary Clinton, yes, might be more hawkish, but she is not an island unto herself, right? She's
right.
still got to work with the Democratic Party. If they're like mainstream national power base of her party, nor the mainstream grassroots power base of her party is with her on super hawkishness on Israel, she's not going to go there.
Yeah.
Now, what she said about her just sort of being able to gloss over the topic, that's entirely possible in a campaign. I mean, that's basically what Obama did in 2012, right?
Sure.
These issues were all out there in 2012, and he still campaigned on, you know, strong for Israel security and didn't really dig in deep to the issues
right.
other than, you know, hitting Republicans, though not Israel, and from an Israel angle about hawkishness on Iran. But he did sort of gloss over it himself. So it's possible that that happens. But as for the sort of proactive, super hawkishness, like, I just don't see that as a possibility, partly because of the way Netanyahu has sort of forced the Israel issue into being a partisan one with the help of the Democrats. I mean, sorry, with the help of the Republicans. But again, those are, the good Republican access is getting so hard to distinguish these days anyway.
Yep.
But I think that he's still Netanyahu. It's not going to be as easy as he thinks it's going to be if in his accounting, Hillary's going to win and Israel's going to get all of its credit back. Like he's burning bridges. Like he's not going to build those back up.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and it's very interesting to watch all of this stuff. That you're right. It's always been there, but it's actually coming out into the open. Ali Gharib,
I was just going to say for a long time. You've addressed this already on your show, but we've known for a long time that Netanyahu doesn't favor a two-state solution. All you got to do is watch the way the guy's government builds settlements.
Of course.
All he's done now, I put this in a Nation column too, all he's done now is he's added word to deed, right? Now he's just come out and said what he's been doing for the past 6 years.
And he even said last year, I mean, he said, and it's so funny watching because, again, in the last day or two, he's tried to reverse himself again and basically he's just gone back to what he said a year ago, which is essentially I support some type of – you know, completely untenable thing that could never actually happen in actuality. So there's no question. Of course he doesn't support a two-state solution. And frankly, you know, there's some on the more soft, they're very marginalized, but there's some Likud guys and some on the right that ironically they're not, you know, they're not bi-nationalists, but they're actually closest to that position because they've advocated give the Palestinians under our control in the West Bank and Gaza, give them some form of citizenship, let them vote. And, you know, with Netanyahu, it's quite clear what the position is. I mean, let's be real. There's no support for two-state solution, and he doesn't want those people to have citizenship. So what does that make him? I mean, the natural word is an apartheid position. That's just reality.
Yeah.
That's just reality.
Yeah, I mean, if you keep entrenching the status quo, at some point it's going to cross that threshold, right?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't debate somebody who said that it already had. Ali Gharib, I really, really appreciate your time. Everybody should look up all of these pieces in The Nation, as well as Ali and Eli Clifton's piece in The Intercept on the MEK. Fascinating, bizarre, disturbing, and important. Ali, I will grab that beer soon. Great to talk to you, man.
All right. Nice talking to you.
Take care.
Take it easy.
All right, folks. Let's just go right into the fun half. All right. You can join us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I'm going to fire up the IMs right now.
And then don't forget, you can support this show by donating to our Indiegogo campaign.
Yes, sir.
We mentioned it earlier, but you know what? Most importantly right now for these next 2 days is the Podcast Awards at podcastawards.com. The last 2 days, today is the last full day. You have till tomorrow around, 9 p.m.?
9 p.m. Eastern.
5 Pacific.
Six. Oh, wait, is it 6 or 5 Pacific? Is it 9
p.m.? Make sure you vote by lunchtime tomorrow. But anyway, you get in one vote today, one vote tomorrow. Go to Politics and News. That's the category at thepodcastawards.com and click on Majority Report. Also, for People's Choice, click on our friends over at Best of the Left. And then scroll down and...
Oh, I guess you could take that down.
And vote for us. Click the submit. And then go to your email. Click the little verify link. And then boom.
Done.
Yep. You can also support this show by... But well, you're the Indiegogo and Podcast Awards right now is the most important.
Become
so
a member. Obviously, that's a
we
great
will
thing
see
to do.
You.
You can write a review for us on iTunes. See you on
in the
fun
better
half.
Half.
Are we fun half or better half? We could do fun better half.
We could do the fun better half.
The fun better half.
The bestest half.
The bestest. I like it.
Sitting up a